It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, President Obama's remarks about the ongoing violence in Ferguson, Missouri, have left some wanting more. A White House reporter will join us to talk about what the president said and how it compares to speeches about other racially charged situations.
Our next guest has been working with public and private leaders in Milwaukee to develop an economic plan which plays to the city's strengths and works to overcome its challenges. The Growing Prosperity Plan looks to improve the local economy, create more jobs, and improve the city's neighborhoods. The plan is being reviewed by the Common Council right now.
Paul Brophy joins us. He's principal with Brophy & Riley LLC, a Maryland-based consulting firm. He's been a consultant to Milwaukee city government as well as to a group of foundations and lenders in the state. He recently wrote an op-ed for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel called Why I'm Bullish on Milwaukee. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, you've spent decades working with older industrial cities to try and reposition them for success in the 21st century economy. Notably, you worked with Pittsburgh after the steel industry collapsed. What makes Milwaukee a unique challenge to you, and why did you decide to take it on?
Well, for a number of reasons. First, you're right. I do work in cities that are trying to find their new economic future. What I find about Milwaukee that's really very special is the two things. One, there is a commitment to the region from the business community, of course, from the elected officials, that really points to figuring out the future based on facts. And the plan that was done by M7 and the plan that nests into that, that I had played a role in with the city, really examine the fact that Milwaukee region and Milwaukee City have a stronger economic base than many other cities in the Great Lakes region, a lot to build from. And in contrast to Pittsburgh, I was there, as you said, when the steel industry collapsed. Pittsburgh had to reinvent itself in a very profound way. What was the economy going to be going forward? The Milwaukee region has much more to build from. The level of industry, manufacturing, as well as growth industries, is much stronger than it was and much more diverse than it was in Pittsburgh back in the 80s. So I think there's a uniqueness in Milwaukee in that there's a lot to build from. And you've got a business community and a government community that are poised to work on a fact-based approach to figuring out how to rebuild the economy and get it stronger.
And you mentioned M7, that's Milwaukee 7, a group of public and private leaders from the seven counties that make up the Milwaukee region. Tell us about what it's aiming to do.
It's aiming to grow prosperity in the region in a couple of different ways. One, building from the strengths of the growing industry sectors. So what are those? There's a big food and beverage cluster in the Milwaukee region. There's a longstanding cluster in power and energy controls that's strong, and a growing water cluster that really dates back to the days when Milwaukee was the brewing capital of the country. And those are jobs that are going to grow. So point one is kind of growing jobs in the economy. And secondly, and the M7 regional plan is very specific about this, understanding that for the economy to succeed, Milwaukee needs to reach out, Milwaukee region needs to reach out and help those folks who are not in the workforce now get into the workforce. Why is that? Because there's growing evidence around the country that those regions that have a smaller gap between the have and have-nots do better economically than those regions that have a wide gap. It's common sense in many respects. The more people you have being productive in a local economy, the stronger that economy can be. So those are the two kind of real key issues. It's both getting more jobs based on the strength of the clusters and taking an inclusive approach so that those folks who are not in the workforce now can get into the workforce and be economically productive.
And that last point is interesting to me, the recognition that poverty is a hindrance to success in this area. But at the same time, there are many different factors that that cause that inequality that you talk about. So what can M7 and other stakeholders in the Milwaukee area do to chip away at that and to close the gap between those who already are employed and those who are looking for work?
And so I'm encouraged by the fact that both the regional plan and the city plan speak to the broad level of improvements necessary in the workforce training and delivery system. Of course, there's a whole other thing going on, which is the effort to try to improve the schools in the city and elsewhere. But on this workforce side, it really is customizing the job training so it fits more closely into the needs that employers have. And often, economic development plans don't speak to that part of the economy, the human capital, the side of the economy. These plans do, which is very encouraging to me.
Mm-hmm. And delving into some of these other points you brought up in your op-ed in the Journal Sentinel, while state officials tend to mourn the fact what they call brain drain from the state of Wisconsin, you say that Milwaukee is facing brain gain. Talk more about that.
Data shows that Milwaukee is gaining numbers of college graduates who are moving into the city, staying into the city compared to other places, which has to do with kind of the quality of life in Milwaukee. I think Milwaukee underrates the quality of its neighborhoods. Milwaukee has quite good neighborhoods. I travel to a lot of cities. I love going to Milwaukee because there are very high-quality neighborhoods to stay in, to visit, to live in. It's got a very good, strong neighborhood base, which is why those college-educated people want to come to Milwaukee or stay in Milwaukee. Quality of life is very important to these mobile workers. And I'm also encouraged by the fact that there really is a very coordinated strategy to improve neighborhoods in the city of Milwaukee. You've got foundations like the Greater Milwaukee Foundation and the Zilber Family Foundation and Northwestern Mutual Foundation working very closely with city government, with state government, and with neighborhood leaders to improve the city's neighborhoods. So there are good neighborhoods to start with, and they're getting stronger because of these efforts. Very candidly, even the worst neighborhoods in Milwaukee look so much better than their comparable neighborhoods in other cities. The neighborhoods are clean, the bones of the neighborhood are good housing in Milwaukee. So there's a lot to work from.
And you also wrote about developing export strategies, that is, finding ways to market what is being produced in Milwaukee abroad. What recommendations do you have in that way?
Actually, that's underway. What's happened is that when the M7 plan was completed, the leadership at M7 look to say, what's the next thing we need to do? And they recognize that building these clusters out means expanding the market for the goods and services in these key industry clusters. So they are working with the Brookings Institution to help companies, large and small, get smarter about how to export their goods and services around the world. All of that an effort to try to get more companies selling more, hiring more people, becoming more robust.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the biggest challenges that Milwaukee still needs to overcome?
So I think the key challenge is, I think there's a good plan, both at the regional level and the city level. What I urged in my op-ed piece last week was to really an all-hands-on-deck approach. These are good plans. I've seen plans all around the country, and I think this is the right blueprint. It really is a matter of making it happen, and that means having the private sector leadership and businesses at MMNC, the regional chamber, and M7, as you mentioned, working with city government, the counties, working with state government, as well as the philanthropic sector, to implement the recommendations that are in these plans. The city's done a good job in organizing itself and a whole set of partners to implement the city plan. I'm encouraged by that, but it really needs a high level of energy and attention.
And what is your benchmark for success? How will you know that we've succeeded in that way?
Population will grow. The labor force participation rate, that is the percentage of people that are working, will grow. the overall economy measured by gross local product will grow. The city administration is currently working with the Common Council to agree on those set of measures for the city. They are also embedded in the plan. So I think there's a real attention to monitoring progress as this progresses.
Paul, thank you so much for being with us today.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
Paul Brophy is a principal with Brophy and Riley LLC, a Maryland-based consulting firm. We've got a link to his piece, Why I'm Bullish on Milwaukee, on the Central Time Facebook page. We're taking a look at the president's remarks yesterday about the ongoing violence in Ferguson, Missouri. Police said they came under heavy fire from protesters last night, and two people were shot, but not by police.
Protesters are angry about the death of an unarmed black teen, Michael Brown. He was shot by a white police officer earlier this month in the predominantly black suburb of St. Louis.
Some analysts called President Obama heartfelt and personal last year when he spoke about the death of Trayvon Martin, another unarmed black teen whose death sparked national conversation about race. But in his remarks yesterday, our guest says the president sounded scripted and distant. Edward Isaac Dover is with us. He's senior White House reporter for Politico. Isaac, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be here.
Let's start by listening back to what President Obama said about Trayvon Martin. He made these remarks after a jury declared neighborhood watchman George Zimmerman not guilty in the trial over the death of Trayvon Martin. Let's listen to the clip.
There are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me. There are very, very few African-American men who haven't had the experience of walking across the street and hearing the locks click on the doors of cars. That happens to me, at least before I was a senator. There are very few African-Americans who haven't had the experience of getting on an elevator and a woman clutching her purse nervously and holding her breath until she had a chance to get off. That happens often. And I don't want to exaggerate this, but those sets of experiences inform how the African-American community interprets what happened one night in Florida.
Isaac, as you listen back to that, how would you characterize his statements?
Well, it's very personal. It's, I think you could say, emotional. He's relating his own experiences to the situation, not just about Trayvon Martin, but as he was saying, of many black men in this country. And he was doing that in a way that he, for a long time in public life, did not do. He was very careful not to speak in those sorts of terms. And if you remember, that's not the first time related to the Trayvon Martin situation that he spoke in those personal terms earlier in the year in 2012, before the trial in 2012, he said, if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon, which was, again, bringing himself very much into the situation, making it about his own experience as well as the larger experience. And that's something that we've seen him do a lot over the course of the last year, not just on the Trayvon Martin situation, but when he's been talking about these issues, when he's been talking about the My Brother's Keeper initiative. He spoke just last month about how he looked out at the people who are in that program, and it's young black and Latino boys and young men. And he said that he sees himself in them. 35 years ago, that's him. That's just a very deep emotional connection that he's making, a deep personal connection that he's making to those things. And it's not what we heard from him over the course of his two statements on the situation in Ferguson.
Mm-hmm. Well, and let's take a listen then to some of what he said yesterday with regards to Ferguson.
To a community in Ferguson that is rightly hurting and looking for answers, let me call once again for us to seek some understanding rather than simply holler at each other. Let's seek to heal rather than to wound each other. As Americans, we've got to use this moment to seek out our shared humanity that's been laid bare by this moment.
And Isaac, what were your thoughts when you heard him speak yesterday?
You have a president obviously talking about the situation, but in a way that is not with that level of personal connection that we heard on the other statements. It's not with that understanding himself, bringing himself into the situation the way that he did in the previous statements. He talked about how there needs to be understanding, there needs to be, he said, we need to listen to each other, not shout at each other, those sorts of things. But it was more of a leader talking about the country, but not as someone who could relate to the experience in a different way himself because of his experiences.
And why do you think there's a difference? Have you thought much about that? And what do you think marks the distinction?
Well, there are a couple of things. The one of the differences is that the clip that you played at the beginning of the statement after the Zimmerman verdict came in was after the Zimmerman verdict came in. And as he said yesterday, this is a situation in Ferguson that is still unfolding in the legal process, and he didn't want to, as he said, put his thumb on the scale. That being said, he, as I was saying earlier in the Trayvon Martin situation, spoke personally about his the connection, essentially, to the Martin situation. So that's one difference. Another difference here is that in Florida, before the verdict, after the verdict, there were protests. They did not get as violent as the protests in Ferguson have been getting. And it seems that the president has put as a priority trying to calm the tensions, not just overall in the way people are thinking about this, but in the streets of Ferguson, trying not to exacerbate the situation. That is something that he needs to make sure to do, and he doesn't want, if the violence gets out of hand, to be anywhere near it rhetorically or anything else. So he's been trying to rail against that, to condemn what is going on there. Even as he said multiple times yesterday, it was a small minority of people who were involved in the violence. He also said over and over again, they need to stop. It needs to not be accepted by anyone.
And I wonder, too, as President of the United States, what else might be on his plate? We heard these statements right alongside some updates that he provided about what's going on in Iraq right now. I'm wondering if we were to turn back the clock and look back at what else was on his plate during the Trayvon Martin thing, would it be comparable? Is he at all, in other words, distracted by other world issues?
Well, being president means that you have to juggle about 5,000 things at once, and so that is what he is trying to do here. But, of course, these two issues yesterday, the Iraq issue and the Ferguson issue, were the ones that flared up in the biggest way. But it is important to note that we had been told that the president was going to come back for basically 2 days to Washington in the middle of his vacation for meetings at the White House. The White House has not told us what those meetings were, and we're not sure exactly why he needed to come back to Washington for them. But that was all before the president ordered airstrikes in Iraq and before the Ferguson trouble began.
Mm-hmm. You point out that unlike with the Trayvon Martin situation, there were no calls yet by him to reboot the national conversation about race. Why might that be?
Well, I think the driving factor, as I said here, is that the White House is looking to try to calm things down, and they think that at this point, anything that he would have said on the topic would have inflamed the situation, possibly on both sides, and that's not what they're looking to do.
Mm-hmm. And looking back at the Trayvon Martin and his response to that, what did we learn as a society? What did we take away and maybe even apply going forward after he put this call upon the United States to talk and think differently about race?
Well, look, a year ago he said we need to have a new conversation on race, and that was a year ago, and now we are where we are. So it's a difficult situation. I think a lot of people on election night in 2008 might have believed that we had come to a new point in the racial divide or racial relations in this country. And certainly the election of the first black president was an important milestone. But it wasn't going to change things overnight, and I think that it wasn't going to change things over the 6 years is what we've learned in a totally revolutionary way. For a lot of people, that's somewhat striking to think, how is it that we have a guy who is the first black president who's now been elected twice, and still we are in a country where what happened in Ferguson happened, and what happened in New York with the Eric Garner choking, or with Ezell Ford in Los Angeles, or with the shooting that happened in St. Louis earlier this afternoon, again, of a black man by, it seems, white police officers.
We're talking to White House reporter Isaac Dover about President Obama's remarks yesterday about the ongoing violence in Ferguson, Missouri. We want to hear from you on this as well. What role do you think President Obama should play in the unfolding situation there? Or in general, do you have remarks about, or do you hope that his remarks would be more personal? Why or why not? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation with Isaac Dover about President Obama's remarks on the unrest in Ferguson, Missouri. We'd like to take your calls. What role does the President of the United States have in these types of situations? What do you wish President Obama would speak about? Would you rather see him get more personal in his remarks about Ferguson? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Isaac, I wanted to talk about Obama's place here in terms of his term as president. He's nearing the end of his term. He's only got about two more years left. Doesn't have to face another reelection. And so, are we expecting him to take a bolder stance on things because he doesn't seem to have anything to lose politically?
Well, a lot of people thought that might happen as soon as he won re-election, but he has been, I think it would be fair to say, a little bit bolder on certain things, including racial issues, but has not been gone crazy on really much of anything. He's still a very cautious man, risk-averse in the way that he thinks about things, and the way that his staff thinks about things. They see themselves as doing better when they focus on the longer, larger approach and less on the jumping in on each passing controversy. But we have not seen any grand, bold plan on anything so far come out of the president. You may make the argument that what he has been trying to do on immigration reform could end up being that, and if he goes through with the executive actions that the White House has been considering that would expand the kinds of protections that he put in for the Dreamers in 2012 to a much wider group, then perhaps that would be it. But so far in the year and a half since he took his second oath of office, we haven't seen it.
And why is that? Why is that his preferred approach?
And that's who he is, in part. That's the kind of person that he is. And it's also, to the White House, a feeling of this is how they have to navigate the current situation that they find themselves in the media, in the news environment, in the political environment, that no matter what they do, they end up getting attacked. So they need to be careful to thread things through in a way that protects them as much as possible.
And on the other hand, it seems as though as a nation finds itself dealing with certain controversies or certain social movements, we look to the president for leadership and sometimes comfort. Have we come to expect that from the office of the presidency, and are we applying those expectations to Obama?
Well, look, the president is seen as not just our leader, but in a lot of people as the person who, when there's a national tragedy, the president speaks. The president speaks for the nation, consoles the nation, grieves for the nation, addresses the problems of the nation. That can be a little bit dangerous when in overthinking, overexpecting what a president can get done. I think that's also perhaps a slightly outdated notion given just how diversified and split the American attention is. We may not see that come out of not just Barack Obama, but any future president in the same way that we did when, when Dwight Eisenhower would get on television to talk to three television channels, and many more people in the country would be watching it proportionally.
Right. We're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Let's talk to Dennis in Fond du Lac. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I just think the role of any president would be to kind of keep an eye on the situation, let the local officials handle it. If they're not doing it, then the government or governor of that state should step in. And then if they're still not handling it and there are civil rights violations, then the federal government steps in.
Thanks, Dennis. And what about that, Isaac? What about the responsibility, I guess, of the local representatives, the governors, the state representatives? What should their role be in these situations?
Well, there was a lot of criticism that came down on Jay Nixon, the governor of Missouri, for not getting involved sooner, for not taking more of a hand in what was going on. But the other, on Sunday night, when he activated the National Guard, that created some frustrations, too. And it was clear in what President Obama said yesterday at the White House that he wasn't completely a fan of the National Guard decision, and said that he just wants to make sure that whatever they're doing, they're showing restraint, but pointed out very clearly that that decision was not his, that that was the governor's decision.
Thanks for that call, Dennis. We go next to Jabril in Milwaukee. Hi, Jabril.
Hi. Obama's made some clear statements about the actual incident, about about what's been going on in the aftermath, and about what's been going on there with journalists. Yet we continue to see the unrest, and I think this is a real opportunity for him to make a statement, to do something a little bit more impactful, and actually go there in person. You know, I think what he could achieve being in Ferguson himself is a lot greater, and you know, if there's anyone who can bridge the gap between the civilians there in Ferguson and the police force, I think it's him. And I think, like I said, that would make a big statement.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jabril. What do you think about that, Isaac?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, the Attorney General is going at the president's direction tomorrow to Ferguson. So Eric Holder will be there to meet with FBI agents and with local leaders, the president has said. He did seem yesterday to not categorically rule out, but pretty much rule out going to Ferguson himself, the president. There are reasons for him to avoid doing it, although obviously there are reasons for him to do it. The reasons to avoid doing it might be that, number one, it could create much more tension just by having him on the ground there. Any president becomes, just due to the thoughts that get attached to the president and the attention that gets attached to the president, they tend to create more tension in already tense situations. The other part of it, which would seem to be on their minds as well, is that, of course, we're dealing with a situation that the local law enforcement has been struggling, some would say failing, some would say being forced to fail to deal with on the ground there. If the president comes to town, local law enforcement is very much a part of that. Mm-hmm. Now, whenever a president comes, it's not just the Secret Service, but you have local police who have to deal with road closings and the motorcade and all sorts of other security procedures. All of that attention and effort would be redirected from dealing with the situation in Ferguson to dealing with the president's presence there.
That's true. And I'm wondering, though, go on.
No, I'm sorry.
Okay, so as Attorney General Eric Holder takes a visit tomorrow, do you expect a change in the tone coming from the president or his administration?
It's hard to tell at this point. It's a situation that is evolving both in terms of what's happening on the ground in Ferguson and in terms of what the administration's response to it is. Part of that is because they are trying to read the situation. Part of it is because there are these ongoing investigations. And we were told yesterday that after meeting with the president, Eric Holder got on a call with a number of stakeholders and civil rights leaders and told them that he was seeing from the Department of Justice investigation that's already underway that there are witnesses in Ferguson who are saying they're not comfortable giving their statements to the local authorities because they fear the local authorities. Those, all those sorts of things go into the calculation of what to do here.
I want to bring up the fact, though, that President Obama is our first African-American president. Does that change our collective expectations of him when it comes to addressing events like these or racial dynamics that we've seen in the last few years?
Yeah, it absolutely does. And it's something that that everybody is aware of, including Barack Obama and all the people who work for him. The trouble that comes for them is that usually people who feel that racial issues have not been addressed sufficiently feel that almost anything that the president says is not quite enough or just enough if, when he goes all the way like he did after the Zimmerman verdict. And those people who feel like too much attention goes to these issues will, when whatever he says, even as restrained as he says it, tend to feel like he is showing some level of favoritism and overreach in talking about these things.
Mm-hmm. What can or should he do then to revitalize the nation's dialogue and perspective on race in the United States?
It may be beyond any man, any one man, any president to be able to get done. He has tried, and he said yesterday that, of course, this is centuries of legacy here that he's trying to deal with. And, you know, he's been president for 6 years. He has had a significant impact on many of these things, but not a revolution in every way of thinking in this country.
Yeah. And so is it then an obligation of the next president to carry that torch and to continue the dialogue?
Look, race is something that is literally written into our Constitution when you go back to the Three-Fifths Compromise. This is something that no matter who the president is or what is going on in the country will continue to be part of what America has to deal with and what runs through so much of American life.
Isaac, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
It was Edward Isaac Dovere. He's senior White House reporter for Politico. It's this week's edition of Teach Me What You Know. Last week, we learned how to cope with empty nest syndrome when kids go off to college.
These days, a lot of people are moving away from their cable TV subscriptions, but still want to watch their favorite movies and shows. WPR technology guy Kevin Trueblood walks us through some options. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to how to disconnect from TV, why are people doing this right now?
Well, when you think about it, it's easy to spend $75, $80, $100 on a bunch of channels that you may or may not be watching. When you break it down, you're maybe watching a couple of channels or maybe just a couple of shows, and the rest of them you're not watching. So why would you pay $100 a month for it?
I think people have felt that way for a while, but there haven't been the options available to make it a viable thing to do unless you wanted to go super low tech and, you know, have no TV. But are there more options now if people want to get rid of their cable?
Well, that's the growing trend in the last couple of years. In fact, in the last 2 years, cable subscription numbers have been going down. And some are suggesting that 2012 may have been the year that cable subscriptions peaked. So what we're seeing are a lot more people that are abandoning cable services in favor of internet streaming services or just going old school, as it were, and putting up an antenna.
Right. So people aren't wanting to give up TV necessarily. This isn't going cold turkey, for instance. We can still watch cool stuff, right?
Yeah, that's right. So there's a couple of different options that you have. One of them being, like I said, you can put up an antenna, or you can find some of the same shows or series that you were watching from streaming services. And there's a number of different ones available.
So antennas from my day when I was a kid were these, you know, giant contraptions on top of a giant, big, wide box. Now you've got flat screens. How does an antenna work with a flat screen?
Well, not much different, actually. You can get as elaborate as you want to with them. If you're far away from a major city center, then you'll probably want to have one on the roof for best reliability. But they've kind of made them a little bit more, I don't know, designer, more flashy. They've made them in these attractive, sleek boxes and things like that that make them look a little prettier. But the concept isn't much different. You still have to orient it in the correct direction. And, you know, if it rains, it might cut out or something like that. But the nice thing is that there are services that will help you maximize your signal. There's a couple of free websites, one being tvfool.com and the other one being antennaweb.org. And you can actually enter your address in, and it'll tell you where to put your antenna in what direction and what you should be able to receive.
Oh, that's helpful. That takes it to a whole new level rather than banging on your TV and just randomly fooling with the wires.
Right. Well, and the other nice thing is with over-the-air broadcasting, it's changed a lot in 20 years since maybe you just got the three big networks. Now those same three channels that were once transmitting in a city now have the ability to what's called multicast, which means you can receive more than one station on that channel. So instead of just one, you can get 3, 4, sometimes 5 and 6. So I counted this morning, like in a city like Madison, you with an antenna, you can actually get 17 channels just from a free antenna. And a city like Milwaukee, you can get over 30. So there's a lot of different options just from plugging in a piece of wire into your antenna or into your television.
So that's not so bad, given that it's sort of old school technology, just hooking up an antenna to your TV. But what about newfangled options?
Well, there's a lot of different options, and there are more being released every day. There's things like smart TVs that have built-in apps. Some of the more popular appliances that are being sold these days are boxes like a Roku box or what's called Chromecast, which is made by Google. And what those allow you to do is they kind of help index and organize all the different streaming options that are available. So if you want to subscribe to Netflix, if you want to subscribe to Hulu or Amazon Prime, which are the major streaming services, they kind of help organize that into one single box. So it's like, so if you want to sit down and watch Netflix, you push one button. If you want to watch Hulu, you watch another. And then all the options that are there for you, the different shows and movies that you can watch there. With Roku, it seems to be more robust as far as partnering with other services like Major League Baseball or other streaming services to help organize them into one spot. So if you subscribe to a sports package or if you subscribe to this entertainment package, they put that into that box for you.
So you mentioned Hulu, Netflix, and Amazon Prime. Can you talk a little bit about what's different about those services? Because that's one question people have when they go this route is you may not want to subscribe to all of them.
Right. But the mindset being that each of those subscriptions, Netflix is $8, $9 a month. Hulu is, $10-some a month. And so what you get is significantly cheaper than what you're paying for cable. Now, your options, I don't consider them to be less. I consider them to be kind of different when you think about it. Now, on Hulu, obviously, that's a lot of content that's being offered on broadcast or network television. But if you're subscribing to Netflix, there's a lot of documentaries and a lot of movies you might not have thought of that are available to watch that you wouldn't have otherwise paid attention to if you were just endlessly flipping through cable channels. So they all have a whole wide array of content that may be the same or maybe slightly different than what you're seeing currently on broadcast and network television.
Now, what about getting channels a la carte? Is that possible?
Through the streaming services?
Through any provider right now, because that's something that people have wanted for a long time, even with traditional cable, that they could select the specific channel.
Right.
How close can we get to that?
Well, with cable and satellite, a la carte is not practical. And I say that because, you think of somebody who goes to a restaurant and just wants to order a salad. That's all they want. And the salad's $10. You have a great meal. But most people, when it comes to like cable subscriptions, want to have a salad, a drink, and some bread to go with it. Well, the problem is that collectively, everybody pays into this pool that pays for the content. And so all the channels become cheaper for everybody instead of just paying for just the one. So if you wanted just ESPN, you'd be paying $20 a month for just ESPN and then $10 more for other channels, whereas opposed to for $40 a month, you can get 100 channels, including ESPN. So collectively, it sounds wonderful for the consumer, but as a pricing model, it may not be practical. What is more, I think, going to happen or at least what is probably more practical is being able to subscribe to those individual services on the internet. And ESPN does have a kind of a subscription service. And so do some of the other channels that you can subscribe to get some of that content that they're offering on their channels. But for cable, I don't think that's probably going to happen.
What if we want to watch, the Packers game, the World Cup, baseball? How do we do that when we've got one of these other services and we're unplugged from cable?
That is probably the biggest difficulty that a lot of cord cutters face when it comes to giving up their cord is trying to find live sports. And the reality is that it isn't easy. For Packers, the advantage is that a lot of their games are on broadcast television, so you shouldn't have any problem seeing them. NFL at least has a subscription service, but unfortunately, you can't watch the game until after it's over. And a lot of other services are the same way. Now, that's fine if you can totally avoid social media and learn how the game, you know, ends. But there are fewer options for that. There are some available. There are some streaming services, but a lot of them are paid. Like, you can subscribe to an entire MLB season. But, you know, that can get expensive. And again, are you paying for a bunch of things you don't want just so you can watch a Brewers game? Do you really want to watch every game that exists? So they do exist, but it is a little bit more challenging. And what a lot of people have done is just look at the more social approach. And what you're saving and not paying $100 a month for cable, you can go to the local brew pub and buy a beer and a burger and watch the game with your friends.
Right. So there's that old school option again. You can just go down to the bar, sports bar, and watch a game on TV. Do you get the sense that this is a sea change that we've seen, people cutting the cord, or do you think it's a trend and people might end up going back to traditional cable?
I think it is a trend. Like I said, we're seeing subscription numbers on cable slowly come down. There's still tons and tons and tons of subscriptions, but there's also a growing trend of what are called, cord nevers, which are a younger generation of people that have never had cable and are used to getting all their content from the internet. And so they don't see the point in subscribing to it because they've always had what they want. That's what they're used to. And so as those people get older, as we see college students, you know, get out of college and move into apartments, much like how wired telephones are kind of getting less and less popular, you're probably going to start seeing more of that too.
Great. Well, Kevin, thanks so much for getting us up to speed.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
That was Kevin Trueblood, one of our technology experts here at Wisconsin Public Radio.